Welcome to What's Your Story podcast. I'm your host, Matt Story. On this pod, I sit down with people of color leaders to understand how they've been able to use their superpowers to make an impact on our world. And I do it one story at a time. Today's guest is Yusef Freeman, Managing Director of California for the Jonathan Rose Companies, which is a green real estate policy, urban planning development, project management, and investment firm. Today's discussion was a bit of going to school for me because I've spent a little bit of time looking into the impacts of real estate on economic wealth gaps between races. And I've looked into some of the policies that the U.S. government has put into place and what impact that's had on generations of underrepresented groups. But Yusef is an expert, and he not only has looked into the research, looked into the history, educated himself, but he's actually doing the work. So I really enjoyed hearing from him firsthand how he's been able to actually apply lessons learned into the work that he does. And then also just hearing how his own personal journey and how his parents both were public servants in the state of California kind of instilled in him this pride of being Black, and how his communities and his family really grounded him in the opportunities that he was able to go into. So his story is one that I definitely enjoyed hearing and also just learned a ton from. And I hope you'll take away some lessons as well. So with that, let's get on to his story. Okay, so today's guest has an extensive background and also developed expertise within the real estate development arena, and he's used those superpowers to really help neighborhoods transform. So I'm excited to speak with him today. So with that, please welcome Yusef Freeman to the show.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
No, thank you for taking the time, brother. So before we jump into what I'm really excited about, a discussion around real estate and the impact it has on communities, I'd love if you could just help the listeners get to know you a little bit better, maybe share a story from your background or give them a glimpse into what little Yusef might have been like.
Well, little Yusef was a very happy little boy, I must admit. From East Oakland, California originally, but principally grew up in South Sacramento, in the city of Sacramento. Both of my parents while I was growing up were public servants. My father worked for the state of California. My mother worked for the county of Sacramento. And I had a very happy childhood that somehow was rooted in the same, I shared the same expectations for myself as my parents did. And I don't know how you work that out. And I hope I can do that with my kids as well. But we were kind of always on the same page about where I should be and what I should be doing. And that limited the conflicts and had a pretty straightforward path through my education to where I am now.
Yeah, that, I think that as a parent, also as a kid, that's very rare that you're on the same page as your parents. So if you could bottle that up and share it with the rest of us, we would all benefit from
dumb luck. It's only dumb luck. I can only imagine.
So as you were growing up, did you have an idea of, you know, the age old, what you want to be when you grow up, or a career you wanted to pursue?
I wanted to be an astronaut. I was really into math and science and was inspired by, I don't know if he was the first Black astronaut or he was just the Black astronaut that was going to space when I was a kid, but a guy named Guy Bluford, and he was my hero growing up. And so between all of the Star Wars and the movies and the toys and the science fiction stuff that I was into with this real life Black superhero who was an astronaut doing it, I wanted to be like him.
Yeah, it's funny how those one points in time really can imprint on you of like, oh, I want to do what that person did, even though we may not even know what it takes to get there. But it's interesting that you were aware of the Black astronaut. So I'm curious from a community standpoint. You said your parents both, you know, working in that similar sector, working for the state. How did your community influence you and your upbringing and just your outlook on things?
Sure. So as I guess most deaf would say, I'm Black on both sides and had some great role models across my extended family on both sides. And so got a chance to see some diversity within Black people and professions and education and levels of success. But I was always sort of drawn to Black heroes, if you will. Like, I would be inspired by the characters. You know, we would always have that one character on TV, on a broad sitcom or action series, there'd always be like the one Black guy or the one Black woman, or in the cartoons, there'd be the one Black character, or in Thundercats, for example, there was, you know, one of the characters where they weren't any race, but one of them was clearly the Black guy, right? And I would always sort of just be drawn to that character and want to learn more about it and what they're doing. And so that was largely my path. My mother would take shirts that had like white characters on them, and she would take like a fabric crayon and color them in to be my shade. Wow. So I could walk around with Black characters on my shirts as a little boy and that type of thing. So
that's awesome.
Being Black was just sort of a natural thing. And I didn't appreciate that other folks maybe didn't have that same experience. That was just the norm for me.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's awesome that she went out of her way to help foster and to fuel that in you.
Absolutely.
So going from that, those astronaut aspirations into your eventual career, what was the delta there? How did you make the transition into, okay, maybe I'm not going to space, but I can still make an impact on this world?
Yeah. Well, you know, there are some major kind of world events that really framed how I ended up getting into the industry of real estate, housing, and community development. I always had a breadth of interests. And one of the things that my father always instilled was, if something is interesting to you and it's a step forward, give it a try. It's not something that you have to do for forever and ever. And so I would do that. And so when I graduated from high school, I was a competitive swimmer and I had an opportunity to swim for a small Division I school in New York. And so I picked up from California when I was 17. I moved to New York and it didn't work out. I was there for three semesters and I transferred back to the Bay Area and was on campus for a brief moment of time, got lost, stumbled into the study abroad office and said, yeah, I'll go someplace for a semester. What do you have left? And they said, well, you've missed the deadline for everything but Egypt. And I said, well, I'll go to Egypt for a semester. And they said, well, if you go to Egypt, you have to go for a year. Okay, I'll go for a year. And went out there and gave it a try and then came back, finished up, and ultimately ended up going back to New York for graduate school. And at the time, I still had this interest in North Africa and the Middle East, international affairs, and I was focusing my studies on that. Happened to be on campus at NYU for a couple of weeks, and September 11th, 2001 takes place. I see the second plane standing in the street, and I look up and I see the second plane hit. I was living on 3rd and Mercer. And so if you remember, after the towers went down, vehicle traffic was closed from 14th Street South, and I lived on 3rd. So it was just a ghost town. And at that time, all of a sudden, if you had an interest in the Middle East, if you had studied some Arabic, and you had an interest in whether it was economic development, public health, now all of a sudden they're recruiting you for things associated with national security, which I didn't have a particular interest in it. And so I pivoted at that point to my other interest, which was, you know, cities. And being originally from East Oakland, growing up in South Sacramento, spending some time in the Bronx as an undergrad, I always had the questions of why did these communities that spent so much time and suffer under a disinvestment that other places haven't. And I got very interested in studying urban economics. I took some internships with, at the time, Mayor Bloomberg's Office of Management and Budget. I also took an internship with a small community development corporation in Brooklyn in Bed-Stuy to really kind of learn about how can we reinvest in these communities, which led me to spending some time with the NEKC Foundation in Baltimore, working in their neighborhoods initiative, then taking a gig with a small research nonprofit that unfortunately isn't around anymore called the Social Compact, which was doing these innovative market analyses. And this was pre-global financial crisis, where they would look at underserved neighborhoods, typically hired by banks, retailers, grocery stores that were interested in making investments in underserved communities that they haven't been in before, and looking to see what the true buying power and economic picture is of these micro locations. So recognizing that low-income areas and areas that have large immigrant populations aren't fully counted by the census, right? And so what could we do looking at data like water usage, other utilities, creating a model for local informal economy to really get a picture of how many people live someplace, how much they're spending outside of their communities to entice these companies to invest in these areas and bring the services to the neighborhoods. And so had a lot of success there before I got recruited and ultimately accepted to participate in a fellowship program at the University of Pennsylvania, which after spending a semester on campus, taking housing finance courses with business students and land use courses with law students and master planning courses with architecture students, this multifaceted program, they would place you with innovative developers across the country doing interesting things in urban revitalization. And that's what took me to your old stomping grounds and my father's old stomping grounds of St. Louis, Missouri.
Yeah. Wow. So there's so many things in there that I wanted to touch on, but you ended with urban revitalization. And so my mind instantly goes to gentrification. And so I would love if you could just differentiate kind of what are preconceived notions that people may have with, you know, some think of gentrification as positive, some think of it as negative, and, you know, everything in between. But we just love that you could just kind of break that down for folks that aren't as familiar with really what goes into those efforts and how that plays out.
Yeah. So gentrification is such an interesting topic, because just in terms of the meaning of the word, we're really just talking about change. And a lot of times when people think about that change, they think about a place where Black people live and all of a sudden outsiders come in with investment and create a community within a community that's already existed, but not for the people who exist there, to the point where the people who have always lived there get pushed out for either economic reasons or cultural reasons as this place changes. And when I think of urban revitalization, and I can give some examples that I've been a part of in terms of revitalizing communities and maintaining that affordability and culture. But when I think of urban revitalization, I think of places that have suffered under policy and economic disinvestment for generations, leaving opportunity away from the people who live there. And so when I think of the revitalization, I think of bringing resources to allow more opportunity to come out of a community. And I'll give you a couple of examples. One that I'm most proud of in my career is working in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. So everyone's familiar, again, another major disaster that had a huge impact on my trajectory and my career. Everyone remembers the horrible impact of the storm, the levees breaking, the damage that just ripped through entire communities and created immense displacement for New Orleanians throughout the city. We were asked by a local nonprofit organization after the storm to come into the Central City neighborhood and spend some time with them and look at opportunities of how we can, to use Joe Biden's current term, build back better within the communities that were destroyed. And we spent time in the Central City neighborhood with the local nonprofit organization and identified two very large public housing communities that had been shuttered due to the storm. I worked for a company at the time called McCormick Barron Salazar that really specialized in these public-private partnership urban revitalization efforts. And so what we did with this nonprofit organization was first engage with the community that had been displaced from the storm. Some were still in the New Orleans area. Others were in the Southeast. Some were actually down being housed by Hugo Chavez down in Venezuela at the time. And we invited everyone to come back. We found folks who had been dispersed all over the country through billboards, through radio ads, using skip tracing technologies as creditors would to find folks and to let them know that there is going to be an effort to rebuild the community in partnership with the residents, and that there will always be the community center open that has full wraparound case management services for those residents. And every single month on a certain day at a certain time, there's going to be a large scale community meeting where you can come and have all of your questions answered and start participating in the process to rebuild. And once we were able to find the community and let them know of the opportunities associated with it, we spent about a month replanning and reimagining what the community could be. And one of the challenges with public housing in the past is that it was really built inward facing and disconnected from the surrounding neighborhood. And so you see these interior courtyards that are typically developed that are facing inside. And the idea is almost to keep people in their public housing community versus fully integrating it with the broader neighborhood. And so one of the first things that we did was reintroduce the street grid that would allow a rebuilt community to be re-knit with the larger neighborhood. We then recognized in working with the community that, of course, we're going to replace all of the occupied public housing units that were occupied during the time of the storm, but we didn't want to have that economic segregation. So we designed rebuilding those units, rebuilding additional affordable and workforce units, and market rate units, and integrating them all. So they were all designed and developed to the exact same spec, and they're all integrated together. So it's not the very low income people live in one side and the rich people live in the other side, fully integrated. And so we're doing a few things, right? We're preserving the affordability and allowing everyone who lived there to return. We are providing additional affordability for the broader neighborhood. And then we're allowing people with choices to want to live in this new comprehensive mixed income revitalization as well. So we're not segregating incomes in what was historically a low income part of the city. And by doing that and by bringing in all of these rooftops and households, then that can create a market for bringing in the retail and the commercial services that previously did not exist in the community. But you want to do that the right way too, right? So we worked with those retailers to have a first hire policy for the people who were returning to the public housing units. And in the community center, we had facilitated job training opportunities, had the cash registers and softwares that are the same that as they're using in the new retail center, yeah, so that they can do the training there to prepare them to work in those jobs. And so it's a real comprehensive approach. It takes time, it takes resources, but at the end of the day, you're able to create the gentrification, if you will, but preserve the affordability and the culture of the community.
No, it's phenomenal to know that you played a part in kind of those efforts, especially as something that many of us saw from afar, but we weren't sure how they were going to come back. And you were literally on the ground helping do that. And I think the thing that I hear in what you're saying is there was an intentionality of we don't want to create inadvertent consequences with this revitalization. And we don't want to set it up in a way that would negatively impact either the communities that are there or the communities that were forced out. And so it sounds like you had a very good perspective on historically things had previously done that. So you mentioned kind of the working of both the public and private sector. You also talked about the policies and having that community center and having, you know, even the courtyards, the way they're designed. And so I'm curious, how did you collect that information, or how did you go back and have that historical to know this is what we've previously tripped up? We being, you know, community revitalization previously has caused those divides and previously has caused it to separate versus bring the community together. Like where did you pull that from, or how did you gain access to that information?
Sure. And so my father grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, and I spent a lot of summers going out there to visit my uncles and cousins and all of that. And one of the largest failings of our country when it comes to public housing took place there, and the most notorious being Pruitt-Igoe, which was the development of high-rise public housing in the near north side of St. Louis, Missouri. And the experiment didn't last very long. One of the challenges with public housing in our country is that it largely goes underfunded, in that annually Congress provides appropriations for the maintenance of public housing. And every year everyone agrees that it costs X to manage, operate, and maintain public housing. And that appropriation from Congress always ends up being a fraction of what that X is. And so we all go in knowing that. And then by the time that those resources are used for administration and other things, about 75 cents on the dollar of what's ultimately needed is what actually gets down to the property level. And so we set it up to fail. And the Pruitt-Igoe high rises, you know, heat going out, elevators going out, they became bastions of crime, drug trade. And I think the straw that broke the camel's back were they started finding people who had passed away and who had passed away for some time prior in their units because of lack of access and being able to get out of the building and heat and those types of things. And so that community was shuttered pretty quickly and demolished. And you know, Cabrini Green in Chicago is another notorious one. And so learning from those lessons and recognizing that we can't just go and warehouse the most low of income households in communities that look nothing like and connect and don't connect at all with the surrounding neighborhoods just isn't going to work, particularly if from a policy standpoint, we know every year we're not going to fund the needed maintenance to do it. And so creating financial structures to right those wrongs and prepare for the future and the long haul and the sustainability had been critical components of how we can do much better when we're redeveloping these communities.
That makes total sense. And one thing we were, before we jumped on, we were talking about is just some of the misconceptions on access to real estate and access to even participating in some of these systems, as you know, whether it's public housing, whether it's, you know, home ownership or other. And so I'm curious, given your view and what you've seen in it, both personally and professionally, you know, what would you want people to know, either historically or even today, that is still creating those inequality gaps, whether it be with wealth, whether it be with access, whether it be with the communities you can live in? And then on top of that, what would you recommend people educate themselves on or look into to be better equipped to understand what's really happening in that space?
Yeah. So, I mean, the biggest thing is historically in the United States, the most consistent and largest transfers of generational wealth has been through home ownership, where you can build equity in the place where you live and then either pass that on to the next generation, or the next generation can sell it and have a bit of a windfall or some cash to then invest in a business, pay for college, or maybe buy another home. Historically, Black people and other people of color have been shut out of that American dream. And the real boom of home ownership came after World War II. A lot of folks returned on the GI Bill. And before the housing markets got crazy as they are today, particularly in the markets that we spend a lot of our time in, people could go use that GI Bill for a down payment, buy a home in a safe neighborhood, and live out what we know as the American dream. When my grandfather returned as a Buffalo soldier from fighting in World War II in Italy, he was given the GI Bill as well, but he was not allowed to purchase a home in any neighborhood that would appreciate. And, you know, the irony of it, and when we talk about things like redlining, oftentimes people think about the banks and the banks drawing these lines saying, we're not going to lend in certain communities. But it goes deeper to federal public policy, where our government actually stated that they were not going to insure any home loans in communities that had significant numbers of African Americans living in them. And so that's where the redlining first came. And there are a few implications associated with that. One, we hear about the term of when a Black family moves into a neighborhood, well, there goes the neighborhood, our property values are going to go down. And when I was growing up, I just thought of that as, oh no, these white folks don't want to live near Black people. But the economics of that were actually true, because what it meant was, if Black people moved into these white neighborhoods, and all of a sudden that threshold of the number of Black people living in these areas would not allow others to buy into that neighborhood and have their mortgage insured, that means that that white household, the liquidity of their asset, their home, dropped dramatically, because now people couldn't just come in and get a mortgage to buy their home when they were ready to move. And so the land value and the home value actually did decrease because of that public policy. And so when you think about the federal government being a player in inciting violence of white neighbors against their Black neighbors, they absolutely did, because the truth of the matter was that because of that public policy and the redlining, if the Black people did get pushed out, their home values would go up. And I think that's something that's largely missed in the discussion of redlining.
Yeah. it's funny. When I was, so I've been very fascinated with the period after the civil rights movement, because if people will describe what we're going through right now as unprecedented, I actually think it is precedent. I think that what happened in the 60s is very similar to what we saw last year. And it was like, the country had a reckoning of, okay, enough is enough, and we're going to do something about it. And I worry that as we go into later years, there's going to be well-intentioned policies and well-intentioned practices put in place that, to what you called out in your example, that don't take into consideration what previously worked and what previously didn't work. Because everything that you just called out, that wasn't someone being, you know, quote unquote racist. That wasn't someone saying, I don't want to live next to a Black person. That was someone actually saying, I'm looking at the value of my home and it's going down, and I can't have that happen. And so when we get into those practices, those things are going to come right back. And I hope for a better future for our kids and you know, their kids and so on. But I just worry that as we think about the uplifting of certain communities, the other part of that is, in some instances, it brings other communities down to get to that equality state. And no one is going to freely agree to that. So I'm just curious, is there anything that you're looking at or anything you're focused on as it relates to what's happening in real estate, as it relates to, you know, commercial development or anything like that, that it we should all be aware of and we should all be paying attention of, whether it's as we're looking to get into the space or even as, you know, voters? Is there anything we should be paying attention to?
Yeah, there's a few things, and I do want to also comment on what you said, because, you know, the example that I gave was the federal government inciting racism and attacks based on race. And now that we can legally purchase in these communities that can't appreciate, it's largely a false right, because we didn't get to take advantage of that generational wealth that passed down to be able to afford that down payment. So even where we have highly educated Black people who are making amazing salaries that their parents and their grandparents could never imagine, they're starting so far back from a wealth perspective that they still can't move into these communities. And so it's an interesting dynamic where this is an extreme, but where the, you know, private equity working African American can't afford to buy into a neighborhood where a white person who's a school teacher is able to live, all because of the wealth differentials that they started their lives with. And so as much as we talk about the income gap, which is absolutely critical, we really need to find ways to look at the wealth gap, because you just can't catch up. How can I put this? People who make money with labor will never be able to catch up to people who make money with money. Yeah. And until there's a way for us to recognize that, remedy that, and provide equity at that scale, then we're always going to have these huge gaps in opportunity by community. So in getting to, you know, what you were saying in terms of things that I'm looking at from an equity standpoint in real estate, there are a couple things. One thing that I really want to mention is, a lot of times when we're talking about gentrification and we're talking about development in our cities, at least in the Bay Area, where there's a strong activist and advocacy community, we like to demonize developers and development, and under the frame of, we need more affordable housing, why are they building these luxury high rises here when we need more affordable housing? And I agree that we need more affordable housing, and we need housing for first responders, for teachers, for folks that really allow our communities to exist. They shouldn't have to commute in from hours and hours away to provide needed services for the people who live there. They should be able to participate in those services as well. One thing that most people don't understand is, one of the largest equity investors in market rate multifamily housing in our country are actually the same pension funds that are the pensions of the teachers, the police, the firefighters. And it's a great irony in some cases to see the people who have those jobs protesting those developments that are ultimately funded by their pensions. And like anything else, it is so critical to follow the money. And I think that there's probably real power there once those communities understand where their investment dollars are going, to change some of the investment criteria associated with those pension funds and have them focus on maybe more affordable housing or other ways to bring affordability and benefits to those constituencies. So that's one thing that I think is helpful for folks to know. Another thing that I'm really focused on right now, so we're in another interesting time during the pandemic, where in many strong market cities, we're seeing rents in multifamily buildings be depressed because high paying jobs are no longer requiring their workers to go into the office, in some cases temporary, in other cases in perpetuity. And those with means are at least temporarily leaving cities, getting more space, maybe in some cases even relocating to places that don't have state income tax, that may have better year-round weather, other quality of life issues. And so with that, we're in a moment in time where rents are a lot cheaper than they have been over recent memory. This gives me an opportunity and the company that I'm with an opportunity to invest in properties that typically large value add funds would look to purchase, rehab, then mark to market those rents. I can now step in and, looking to preserve affordability, I can offer as much from an acquisition price as those value add funds, but I can partner with a local nonprofit organization and say, I will cap rents and in perpetuity keep those rents affordable to households earning up to 80% of the area's median income. And in exchange, the state of California will give me a property tax exemption for those units. And so during this period of time, I'm able then to have an operating budget that looks a lot better than the market rate folks who wouldn't be able to get that property tax exemption. I can buy that asset at what the current market price would be, but preserve affordability and perpetuity. So that's something I'm super excited about right now and looking to do as much of as possible in the near term.
That's awesome. That's something that I don't think any of us would have seen as a byproduct of the current environment, the current culture, the current movements of, you know, folks, whether it's leaving or moving out and whatnot. So it's great to hear that there are people like you that are creating opportunities out of it, as opposed to seeing it as all negative and not necessarily something that's going to be a benefit. So I could keep going on and on about this. This is something that I'm just naturally curious about, but I do want to switch to the brand of USEF for a little bit and just tie into a bit more about you and your journey. And so we were connected through our better halves. Our wives are friends, and we became friends through them. And since then, we've also had children and continue to go on with all the life milestones. So I'm curious for you, how has husbandhood and fatherhood shaped your journey and had an influence on where you are today?
Yeah, it has the single biggest influence on me now, which is so bizarre if I even just look at where I was 5 years ago before this journey began. And now, like you, with two kids, it's a completely different planet. I live and work for them, thinking about their future, their happiness, and, you know, their happiness really is my happiness. I get no more joy than the smiles and laughter from both my kids and my wife, if I'm being honest. And so everything that I do is really to set up for them. And I'm, you know, life is funny in that we look at things, and, you know, I'm a Gen Xer, and so, you know, I can look at the next generation and say, well, back in my day, we used to do this, or you had to go through that, and, you know, I didn't really start using the internet till I got to college and all of those things, right? Yeah. And now that I have kids, I actually, you know, with technology, I want their lives to be easier than mine. I want them to have as many choices as possible. I want to expose them to everything and allow them to pursue anything. And so that's my principal motivation and why I get up in the morning and go to work and do what I do.
Yeah, I 100% agree with all of that. It's funny how we, you know, I remember as a kid, you never wanted to think you would turn into your parents. But, you know, with every day passing, it's like, wow, I totally get why my mom did that. I get why my dad did that. So 100% agree there. So for you, you know, and one of the things that I like to find out about people, because I think it allows us to help each other, is our superpowers. And it could be something that we take for granted that others see in us and they're like, wow, I can't believe the way you're able to do that, or the way you're able to, you know, facilitate this, or the way you're able to manage that. So I'm curious for you, what would you say is a superpower that you bring to the table?
Well, I'll say it's a superpower, and my wife may say that it's something that she's not too excited about. But you know, I have an ability, I would say, to not be overly concerned about how I feel about something in the moment. That I have always been able to look at the bigger picture and recognize that if I do something today that I just may hate and not want to do, that will lead to something that I really want, or it's going to be extremely important for our family or a win for the organization. And so I've always been able to have a broader global outlook and not be too concerned about how I feel about something today, because I can see the impact that it'll have in the future.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because that directly ties into everything you were just talking about in terms of your work and how you're able to pour into these opportunities that are going to have that impact down the line. It's not, I can assume it's not easy. I can assume it's not straightforward. It's not something that is, you just wake up and it happens. So it sounds like you've definitely found an arena to bring your superpower to bear that others are able to benefit from it as well.
Definitely takes patience.
Yes. on our side and all those that work with us side.
That's right.
Have you had a Mama, We Made It moment?
I think so. When I was wrapping up that project in New Orleans, I was invited, Barack Obama was president at the time, I was invited to the White House to give a presentation on all the work that we did there. And subsequently invited a few months later to have breakfast in the West Wing. And while I didn't get to sit down with the president, it was just an amazing honor. And being able to share that with my parents at the time was really an important moment for us.
That's awesome. No, that definitely qualifies. So I'm going to close out with a little bit of fun. When they turn your life story into a movie, who would you want to play you on the big screen?
Well, since I have two little kids, I would say Grover from Sesame Street. Okay. I appreciate the diverse roles he can play, from yes. waiter to superhero and everything in between. And my son will actually sit down and zone out watching Grover go through all of his activities. So that's probably the way I could get his attention the best.
So that's going to set up a great answer for my next question then. What would be the song that plays in your trailer?
Well, this wouldn't be Grover appropriate, but I would say 93 Till Infinity from the Souls of Mischief. They're from East Oakland, which is where I still rep being from. And 93 was the year that I qualified for my first all-star team in swimming. And so that always sticks out as kind of taking a big step forward and what I was striving for in my life at the time. So I would go with that one.
Yeah, it's funny. So this is a new question that I've added in this season. And I believe, and I'd have to go back and chart this, but everyone's song is pretty close to like their teenage years. And there's something about when you're listening to music at that point that it just sticks with you. And no matter your age, it's, you know, whatever you're listening to, because I had a conversation with someone and, you know, for me, ATLians was the thing.
Oh, yeah.
And I had never been to Atlanta. I probably couldn't tell you anything about Atlanta beyond what I heard on that album, but it was like, that was the album for me because it was, you know, teenage years and like, I'm able to actually get out and get to pick what's on the radio and whatnot. So it's funny that you picked out the year too, because I think that's something that's consistent across the board for most people.
That's awesome. Actually, that album was my true introduction to Outkast my freshman year in college, when my roommate when it got released, just played it back to back in our room.
So I'm a huge fan of stories. It's why I sit down and try to hear from people like yourself and just learn from others' lived experiences. But for you, if there were three people and they could be with us, they could have passed, that you could sit down with and just hear their story firsthand, who would they be?
Yeah. I mean, the first would be my father. He passed away toward the end of last year. And while my relationship with him was absolutely awesome, we were best friends, and I got so many stories of growing up and his experiences. I'd do anything to sit down with him again and just do it all over again. Another is Guy Bluford, that astronaut that I told you about, who was a hero of mine growing up. I would love to talk to him. And then the other is Anthony Nesty, who was the 1988 Seoul Olympic gold medalist in the 100-meter butterfly. He's from Suriname. Like, he upset Matt Biondi, who's local to the Bay Area, and went to Cal. And he was the first Black gold medalist in swimming, and inspired me to want to compete as a swimmer. And he's now head coach of the University of Florida. So those are the three that I would love to spend more time with.
That's an awesome three. So is there anything I didn't ask that you want to share, or anything you want to ask me?
So you have probably more going on than anyone that I know. and by all accounts, you get great reviews and all the things that you're doing. What's motivating you to do the extra? Because you're an executive at a huge company. You're a husband. You have two daughters. You are making a lot of things happen right now, and then said, okay, let's go do this podcast on top. let me be a partner in some entrepreneurial ventures. What's motivating you to do all this stuff?
So it's a great question. It's one that I've thought a lot about. And what it boils down to for me is the one resource that I can't create more of is time. And I'm very well aware of that. And for me, for whatever time I'm given in the rest of this life, I want to use it to do things that I want to do. And there's certain things that I just feel that I was, you know, whether you're religious, whether you believe in fate or whatever it is, there's just certain things that I think I was put on this earth to do. And when something aligns to my overall mission, and my mission is I want to inspire my tribe to be the best they can be and to do the things they want to do. That's, you know, my family, that's my colleagues, that's my community, that's my, you know, my brothers that aren't, you know, blood, but, you know, through life. And so for me, if it's lining up with that, then I got to find time to do it. And so it may mean that I'm getting up a little bit earlier. It may mean that I'm staying up a little late. I'm, you know, multitasking here and there. But it's almost for me, I don't have time not to do these things, because I know that there's going to come a moment in time when, you know, the hourglass runs out, and I hope that I can look back and say, you know what, I did everything that I was supposed to do. So that's where it comes from for me. But it's not easy. I'm fortunate, as I know you are as well, to have a partner that supports me and says, yes, you can have that time to go do this thing, even though we do have the daughters and food needs to be made and, you know, the house is a mess and all the other things that trip us up. But I think having that conversation of, like, these are the important things, and, you know, finding the time for them has been something that I've tried to be very intentional about. Because I would say, in, you know, and no matter where you are in your life, you could probably resonate with this, but there's been times in my life where I wasn't intentional and I wasn't getting as much out of the time I was spending doing things. And the reward is definitely worth it, no matter how, you know, how much I'd love to get a 10-hour night of sleep or, you know, whatever the other thing I could be doing is. So yeah, that's what it comes down to for me.
I don't have time to not do these things. That's powerful, man. That's powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. So before we go, if people want to connect with you, they want to follow along with what you're doing, where should I send them?
Probably LinkedIn. You can shoot me a note from there. It probably will take me a little while to respond, just because of the whole interface that they have on that platform. But I'm on it, and I eventually get to everything.
Cool. All right. Well, I'll include that in the show notes. But again, I appreciate you taking the time. This is, as I said, this is one that I think is really important, and it's one that not enough of us know enough about. And I appreciate you sharing your perspective, your story, and educating us so that we can all be a bit of bigger part of the solution to hopefully drive to more equitable and inclusive communities across the globe.
Honored to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of What's Your Story podcast. If you enjoyed it, please hit the subscribe button on your favorite podcasting platform, or you can follow me on any social media platform at @MattEStory, and I'll keep you updated on new episodes. Also, if you're interested in learning more about some of the things I'm up to, head over to MattEStory.com and sign up for my newsletter. And lastly, do me a favor, share this with one other person in your network that you think might enjoy it. And don't forget to keep sharing your story.